Sunday is Earth Day. It's been 37 years since the first Earth Day, started by Gaylord Nelson, who was then a U.S. senator from Wisconsin, who proposed a nationwide protest to put environmental issues on the national agenda. It's considered to be the birth of the modern environmental movement. Since then, 20 million people or so have participated in annual gatherings to promote good environmental stewardship of the planet. It's now observed each year by more than 500 million people and governments in 175 countries. I had a boss who was really into this. Actually, for this boss I had years ago, every day was Earth Day because he treated us like dirt.
Oh, there is the joke.
Here to talk about these sort of issues is my buddy Joel McCower, who writes about green issues and clean technology and corporate environmental practices and that sort of stuff on his website, readjoel.com. Hi, Joel. How are you today?
Good, Paul. It's always great to hear from you.
Earth Day needs a better name.
Yeah, what do you think?
I don't know. Well, you can't take Green Day. You'd be sued by the rock band.
Planet Party?
Planet Party isn't bad.
Something, because I think for a lot of people, because it started in 1970, the Earth Day image is of a bunch of hippies smoking dope and talking about how cool trees are. Am I wrong?
You mean it's changed?
It sounds too much like birthday, too.
I don't know. You know, I think we're stuck with that, but I think what we have to do is just... in some ways, figure out how to brand a lot of these, the problems a little bit differently. I mean, you know, climate change, global warming. I mean, you know, we all like a change of climate now and then.
Yeah.
And what's so wrong about things getting a little warmer? I mean, hell, it's cold a lot of the time, you know?
That is part of the image problem of trying to educate people on these topics. Now, one of the things that you do as a speaker and writer and consultant is you deal with big companies. And you've actually helped many of them, including our friends at Anheuser-Busch here, realize that being green can help them make green, can accrue to their bottom line in a positive way, right?
Well, yeah, this is really, I mean, from a business perspective, being a green business is really being a better business in that, you know, if you think about pollution or waste from a business standpoint, it's really something that the company bought but couldn't sell, had no value to the customer, and they had to pay to get rid of it. And so it's wasted money, wasted profit, and, of course, a lot of that waste turns up in the form of carbon emissions or hazardous waste into our rivers and streams or whatever. And so a lot of this stuff is just really good business practice. I'll give you an example. You mentioned Anheuser. A number of years ago, they figured out how to redesign their beer cans. They actually tapered the top of it, and so it reduced the diameter by, I believe it was an eighth of an inch. They didn't reduce by a drop what went inside, but in doing that, they reduced by tens of millions of pounds a year of aluminum that they would need. And when you think about it, aluminum is one of the three most energy and therefore climate-intensive industries. When you think about, you know, mining bauxite and the incredible energy intensity that goes into aluminum, it was a significant environmental initiative. Now, they're not going to put a green seal on Bush and Bud, but it was just good business.
And there are also companies like Walmart that are now doing this. Walmart is hated by some groups in this country, but they're actually starting to take the lead on green issues, aren't they?
Well, Walmart discovered its green gene about a year ago, and it really has just done some amazing things. And in terms of trying to be a leader in selling, you know, organic foods and organic cotton and creating markets for some of these things that are still pretty niche, and they're, you know, Walmart's biggest cost is people. Their second biggest cost is energy. They're one of the largest energy users, certainly private sector in the United States, maybe the world. So if they can reduce even by small amounts here and there their energy use, it's significant. So they're trying to, for example, double the efficiency, the fuel economy of their trucks, which only get these big semis that you see on the highway. They only get 6 mpg now, and they'll get in 7 or so years 12 miles per gallon. And that's tens of millions of dollars to their bottom line. Does that make Walmart a green company? Absolutely not. They've got huge issues, huge impacts. Most of their stuff is being shipped across from China. They've got, you know, of course, major issues with labor and spying on employees and community impacts and all that. But from an purely environmental perspective, they are now one of the leading companies.
Now, do you think that trickles down to the consumer, A, as a cost savings for them in Walmart stores, and B, is Walmart pushing the green message to their consumers?
Yes, they're starting to. I think you'll be seeing it more and more in that, for example, I mean, one of the things that got Lee Scott, their chairman's eyes around this, and where they really saw this as an opportunity, is that they, you know, one of the things they just stocked, and somehow, I don't know how it came to them, were organic cotton, I think it was yoga suits.
Right? Yoga suits?
Yoga outfits or some yoga wear. I don't know. I don't know enough about what.
Like exercise wear.
Yeah, something, but organic cotton. And they stocked them, and the darn things flew off the shelves. People wanted them. And so they realized that people who are health conscious also, you know, in terms of exercise and wellness, also wanted products and things that they put in or on their body that reflected that, and, of course, the things they eat as well. And so they realized that organic and healthful like that, you know, healthy for the planet products was not something for, you know, rich elite or hippies or tree huggers, whatever, that their middle America customer, the mid-market customer, also wanted these kinds of things. And so they saw this was, first of all, an opportunity to improve their not-so-great image in a lot of ways, but second and most important, a way to create new markets and sell products and bring the price of some of these things down in the classic way that Walmart does that.
And we're seeing that also in the local supermarkets here. The two big chains, Schnucks and Deerberg's, they're really pushing the organic side of that. Maybe some of that is because Walmart is also in the supermarket business, but also they probably were trying to get some of their customers back from companies like Whole Foods.
Sure. And, well, you know, Walmart's now the largest buyer of organic produce in the country. It's still a small percent, but they're so big that any percent they do of anything is going to be huge. And you know, they're starting to compete with Whole Foods in some ways, and at least for certain kinds of customers.
Now, do you have to be a big company like a Walmart, an Anheuser-Busch, a General Electric to get into this game?
No, not at all. In fact, a lot of the most innovative companies are small ones that are just finding better ways to do this. And in fact, I just gave a speech in Chicago yesterday and was talking about the fact that some of these small companies really can become change agents. So here's an example, and refers to a company we were just discussing. There's a beer company, a brewery in the Denver area called New Belgium Brewery. They make Fat Tire and a bunch of brands, actually some of my favorite beers. Aside from the fact that they're good beers, they also are extremely progressive in their one of these companies that was sort of born around an environmental ethic, and they do everything sort of right. And I met the COO, the chief operating officer of the company. I was talking to her, and she said, "Oh, well, yeah, we sit down with the local breweries a lot in the Denver area, and we share what we're doing." And I said, "Oh, yeah, like who?" She said, "Well, Coors and Anheuser-Busch." So. And there's another example of a company called New Leaf Paper, based out here in San Francisco, that makes really one of the leaders of recycled and chlorine-free papers. And they're influencing some of the largest paper makers, Domtar, which used to be Weyerhaeuser. They're influencing the way by teaching them and helping them. They've really become change agents to change their sector, too. So there's a lot of power for little companies, not just to help their customers, but also to grow the market.
And the real message there is, this isn't just something that's a feel-good proposition. It's actually something that your shareholders or your ownership is going to like, because it's going to be positive economically.
Well, we've definitely transformed from the place where this is a movement to where it's now a market. In fact, the way I describe it is that in the early years, this was a way of, you know, sort of doing well by doing good, maybe, you know, improving your bottom line by being more efficient with your energy use and, you know, things like that. But it's now able to grow. This is where the point where we can now grow the top line, which means increase revenue, not just decrease costs, through new innovations and products and new markets and new kinds of products and even new business models.
You'll find more of Joel's thoughts on these things on his website, readjoel.com. His main business these days is greenbiz.com, right, Joel?
That's right. Greenbiz is sort of the site for business and the environment, news and information, all sorts of stuff, and it's all free.
Now, I want to talk to you about this. I don't know if it was a controversy or if it was a blip on the environmental media a month or so ago when Al Gore's house kind of got outed. Here's the guy who did An Inconvenient Truth and talks all over the world about global warming and climate change and how people need to do what they can individually. And then somebody, I guess, went to check the records and found out that he uses an enormous amount of energy and he's got a huge house in Tennessee or whatever the story was. And then the other part of the story that I did didn't understand, which I need you to explain to me, is he started talking about carbon offsets and the carbon footprint and being carbon neutral. Okay, whew, right over my head.
Yep, over a lot of people's heads. It's a tough thing. Well, you know, I mean, I think Al, you know, did get caught. I mean, I admire the heck out of him, what he's been doing, and he certainly has changed the conversation and brought awareness of carbon stuff to a lot of people. And I guess, and by virtue of this story, you know, clearly there are people out there who wanted to get him and show them that he's not as pure as. I don't think he made himself pure, but he you know, there's always people who want to get these guys who are trying to
take him down a notch.
Yeah, no, take him down a notch. You know, You know, I guess what he also demonstrated is that, you know, this is tough, you know, to change your own habits. And there is this whole thing about carbon offsets and carbon neutral. So let me try and break it down, and forgive me, this is not easy stuff. One of the things we're all trying to do is figure out how to reduce our impact on climate change. And so much of what we do, our impacts, come from the energy that we use. Now, it's not the energy itself, but it's generating that energy in the case of electricity, and burning the energy in the case of cars. So those two things are the energy we use in our home. So any electricity we use and any gas you burn generates, I think, a very large part of most people's what they call their climate footprint, the amount of their contribution to climate change. So how do we reduce that? Well, first of all, what everybody's doing right now is you can offset it. Right, so it means you can pay somebody else to, you know, plant trees or do some other things, and there's some services where, for, you know, 10 or 30 or 50 or some number of dollars a month, based on your own footprint, how much you drive, what kind of car, how many miles it gets, how big a house, and is it heated by oil, gas, or whatever, you can figure out, okay, this is, you know, we generate some tons of carbon based on our lifestyle, and at $6 or $8 or $10 or $20 a ton, you can offset that. So all good to an extent, but not really.
It seems to me like that entire plan is, I don't want to turn down my thermostat. Here's $20. Leave me alone.
Well, to a certain extent, that's true. But so here's the issue. So you remember, and you have a daughter who probably teaches you this. If you don't remember, way back when there were the three R's. Remember the three R's of environmental stuff?
Recycle, reuse, refuse.
No, it's not quite close. It's actually reduce, reuse, and recycle. And it's not just an alliteration. It's not just. It's actually a hierarchy. So this is now. I mean, this is a little tangent, but it'll take me 90 seconds. The first thing you want to do with reducing your waste is you want to use the least amount of stuff. Just be as least wasteful as possible. The second thing is that of the stuff you do use, you want to reuse it. In other words, that may be a refillable, a rechargeable something. It may be just be something that lasts longer and is durable and doesn't have to be, you know, use it and throw it away kind of thing. Whatever form we use, maybe it's even just renting something instead of buying it. So you use the least amount of stuff, use the stuff you do have as much as possible, and then at the very end, whatever's left over, you recycle. Now, people forget that, and they go right to recycling thinking that's the be-all, end-all, even though it's a third choice. So with carbon, with climate, it's efficiency. Use the least amount of energy to do what you need to do, which means that, like, the highest mile per gallon car or the most energy-efficient light bulbs or whatever it is, or turning things off when you're not in the room, your computer, your lights, whatever. So efficiency is first. Second is that of the energy that you do use, by the highest percentage of, if you can, power that was generated by solar or wind or others. And a lot of utilities you can buy what's called green power. And once you've done that, you've used the least amount of energy and the highest percentage of so-called green energy, then you want to offset the rest. That's the goal. But if you go right to offsets, it's, yeah, well, sure, I can drive my Hummer as far as I want. It's carbon neutral.
Because I'm paying off somebody else to plant trees.
So I believe that, you know, doing that, exactly that, paying someone off, it's kind of like having a Diet Coke with your double bacon cheeseburger and calling it a balanced diet. As a matter of fact, you're asking someone else to drink the Coke for you.
That's a great analogy. And the interesting thing is, we talked in the first segment here about companies and their bottom lines. Don't you think part of the appeal of being green for individuals who may not usually care about that is the fact that their bottom lines are being impacted as well. I mean, we've seen this in the last couple of years as gas prices have, you know, gone on that roller coaster, and now we're at the 275 or 270 mark here in St. Louis. I'm sure out in California where you are, it's been over $3 for quite a while now. And those seem to be the thresholds where people do start thinking about getting those hybrids or those more fuel-efficient vehicles. And doesn't that have to be part of the mass market appeal of being green?
I guess it should be, but it, you know, hopefully it isn't. And
because I don't think appealing to people's consciences is really going to work on a multi-million person level.
Well, let's try something else. I mean, first of all, about money, I don't think this is going to get expensive enough for people to really make that much of a difference. And I hope it doesn't, because it, you know, we all get into issues there. But you know, with financial difficulties, when gas prices get too high, we have to curtail our lives in certain ways. But you know, I think one of the biggest mistakes the environmentalists did around climate change is they turned it into an environmental issue. Yes, it's an environmental issue, but it's a public health issue. It's a human rights issue. It's the future of our kids. It's infectious diseases. It's, you know, the ability to, you know, for the Mississippi to be flooding, and I mean, just it's all these huge disruptive things that have, you know, not necessarily have, can have huge pocketbook issue impacts, but it's not simply about saving a few dollars at the gas pump. But and that's one of the big problems between Earth Day 37 years ago and Earth Day now. Okay, so when you think about environmental issues back then, you know, they were kind of simple. I mean, you know, there was a cause and effect that, you know, some oil, you know, some drunken sailor runs into his ship into an iceberg, and all of a sudden it's flooding, you know, or it's you know, spilling. You know what I'm talking about? You know,
the Exxon Valdez, yeah.
You know, they were local. Now they're global. They were immediate then. You know, now they're long term. They used to be visible. You could see it, and you know, in your community. Now they're invisible. They used to be kind of short-lived. It sort of happened, and then it would go away. Now they're persistent. They used to come from a single cause, you know, one cause and effect. Now it's multiple causes. And they used to seem like pretty solvable. If we just stop doing that, the problem will go away. And now it seems like they're out of our control. And so the challenge now to get consumers engaged is not just a matter of, oh, we'll pay a little bit more, we'll do this thing. But it really is sort of understanding that this is about our future in a lot of different ways. And there really has to be sort of an ethic, just like we learned, you know, smoking isn't good and you have to wear seat belts and things like that, that we realize that we have to change the way we do things a little bit differently. Doesn't mean we have to live in a cold, dark world and not do anything, because there's all sorts of technologies and products and things that we can get that will help us. It's just that we have to be aware of them and think about how to, and get our politicians and everyone else thinking in those terms too.
Talking with Joel McCower, who has been writing on green issues for over 20 years now and has the website greenbiz.com or his blog at readjoel.com. Most people don't know that this Sunday is Earth Day. Seems like it's getting absolutely horrible marketing. And speaking of marketing, Joel, you know, if you went back 10 or 15 years ago, you could go into stores and find products that were claiming to be green or biodegradable or non-toxic or recycled. There was a big push for that, which we don't see anymore. Why is that?
Well, there's two reasons, Paul. One is that, first of all, some of those things have actually just become normal. And so they're not, they just, you know, a lot of these things have been phased out of products across the board, so it's no longer worth advertising. But a lot of those early products, you know, they just kind of didn't work, you know. That was, I think, gave a black eye to the whole idea of buying green, is that, you know, you had these biodegradable trash bags that degraded, you know, didn't degrade or maybe degraded a little too early. You had, you know, recycled paper, personal toilet, you know, or...
Oh, I tried some of that. Product. That was horrible. You know, was, toilet paper made out of recycled paper, not good on the tush. I just got to tell you that.
Chunks of wood, you know, whatever. And you know, I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit here, but a lot of this stuff, you know, just didn't live up to its branding. It, you know, and what we realize now is that for green products to succeed in the marketplace, they have to be more than just as good as the incumbent. They actually have to be better. because there is some skepticism about, you know, green. I mean, there's a percentage of people, maybe 8 to 10% of consumers in out there, the people who go to Whole Foods and others, who just sort of take it at face value, and they trust the process, and they're willing to do that, and it makes them feel good, and for whatever reasons, and they'll buy these things. But I think most people won't yet, and I think it's a problem, you know, because we don't really know what green products are. Now, I mentioned earlier a little while in the hour about this example of, you know, Anheuser-Busch, you know, redesigning their beer can and saving aluminum and in effect making it a greener product. And I think that actually, or perhaps ironically, a lot of the things that we buy today are greener because companies have dramatically cut out the waste and inefficiency and the energy that they put into these things. They've cut out a lot of the toxic materials, not simply because they're trying to save us, but because it was causing them problems. They had toxic waste problems. They had, in some cases, investors or others pushing them. Maybe it was the communities that didn't like those toxic materials around. So a lot of this stuff is happening around us, and the products we buy today are, in fact, a lot greener than they used to be. Are they green enough? Of course not. We have a lot to do, but I think we're going to start seeing these products. You know, we talked about Walmart. GE had big eco-imagination. You probably saw the dancing elephants and things on television. And we're seeing a lot more products, a lot more companies that were afraid to talk about this stuff. And there's reasons that they're afraid. But they're a lot less afraid now. And now that those companies like GE and Walmart that were sort of big, bad companies are sort of doing this and not getting killed, I think the world is seeing it. Corporate world that says it's safe again, let's jump back in, and we'll be seeing more products.
You know, if the marketplace is jumping on board this bandwagon for whatever reason, whether it's because it's less toxic for them or because they think it's good business or it turns out to accrue to their bottom line, as we suggested before, do we leave it to them, or does government have a role in this? I read a story this week about your home state of California, where what are you paying for gas out there? It's like $3.25 a gallon, something like that?
At least.
There's a legislator out there who's proposing a gas guzzler fee for people who are driving a Hummer or a Ford Expedition, and rebates to people who are driving more fuel-efficient cars. I thought the whole idea of buying a fuel-efficient car was that in itself was your built-in rebate.
It doesn't pay for itself yet. But here's the thing about California. I mean, over the past 20 years, as the California economy has just boomed in so many ways, and far, far, far more so in general than the rest of the country, our energy use has been absolutely level. The population has grown, industry has grown, the economy has boomed, but there's been zero growth in energy use while the rest of the country has gone up 50%. So as a result of California and Californians have sort of come to this understanding that this is all really good for us. We don't necessarily like every little thing, but the standards and the requirements and the requirements to have renewable energy in the system and all the government buildings and in our homes and the gas taxes on different things ultimately turns this into a more economically productive and profitable state.
So you think that the public sector needs to be there? It just can't be the private sector doing it?
Well, I'm not a big advocate of taxes, and I don't think that there should be the heavy hand of government, but there need to be carrots and sticks. The government, I mean, first of all, you know, there needs to be a level playing field for energy. We don't, you know, people say, well, you know, why go with solar? It's so expensive, but nuclear power is so cheap, and it doesn't give off any climate emissions the way coal and oil and natural gas do. And the fact is that, you know, nuclear power is so subsidized. We don't even know what it costs because no company has ever had to, on their own, build a plant, run it, store the waste, insure it, and decommission it when it was at the end of its useful life because the government pays for most of that stuff. And so, you know, of course it's not a level playing field, and if they took away all those subsidies, wind and solar and all those things would be they'd be cost effective. And so, you know, the government needs to figure out, it's not so much about tax and policy, Paul, but it really boils down to one word, leadership. If we had leaders in Washington who said, we believe that that clean energy is not just about saving the birds and the trees. It's not even just it's not even just about stemming the problems, the worst effect of climate change. This is the biggest opportunity we have to grow jobs and new businesses in a clean technology way that we can export to the rest of the world, much of the way that all those corrupt countries are exporting oil to us now, that this is one of the biggest economic opportunities ever to face us. And this is another conversation for another day. That's the kind of leadership that would really spur this whole movement, solve a lot of our environmental problems, level the playing field, get those efficient cars that we've all been wanting out onto the streets and into the showrooms in the streets, and you know, and spur the private sector to do these things. But you need somebody saying that this is important, and our leaders aren't doing that.
All right, we'll leave it there. I'll send you to readjoel.com for more information, or his other website, greenbiz.com. Joel McCower, thanks as always for your time today, and happy Earth Day, I guess.
Many happy returns, Paul. It's always a pleasure.
It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.